Hi, everybody, and welcome to Pharmacy Pathways. We are here with Dr. Tony Rodriguez, and he is going to be talking about the profession of medical writing. So, thank you, Tony. Thanks. It's good to be here.
Yeah, thanks. This is exciting.
And I know Tony because we actually used to work together. And we used to talk, he used to tell me about what he was doing medical writing wise in our brief discussions about it. But then at some point, I had a deeper interest to get into it myself. So I gave him a call and he generously shared all this information with me. And now I've gotten into medical writing myself. And I think it's a hidden gem within the field of pharmacy. And who else better to come talk to us about medical writing than you?
There are some better people.
Okay.
But I'm going to interrupt you too. It's not what wasn't so generous. I wanted to steal information from you about speaking. So I had writing information, you had speaking and presenting.
Okay.
And so
We
that
exchanged it.
conversation was a mutual
It was a
exchange.
mutual
Yeah.
exchange.
Yeah.
Okay. So then we'll just get right into it. So tell us a little bit about your background and where you're from.
Of course. So educational background. So I'm a pharmacist by training. And well, I guess school, I say training. That's such a weird way to say it. But
Well,
so I'm from
yeah.
Winchester, Virginia. Born and raised there essentially, and graduated from John Hanley High School right in Winchester. I mean, if you know of Winchester, you know of Hanley. It's a great high school. Went to Shenandoah University in Winchester for my undergrad degree in biology. I did community college first. Got my biology degree from Shenandoah, and then my doctorate in pharmacy from Shenandoah as well. So pretty much
Oh,
everything, right,
you were
in
a
Winchester.
trooper, okay.
Yeah. Now there are some years. It took me a couple of years to figure out what I'm doing, why I want to do pharmacy, and that kind of stuff. So I didn't graduate pharmacy school until I was 28. So it took me a little time to kind of figure it out. It wasn't a direct path. Right after that, I was lucky enough to get a residency in Meritus, which is a hospital in Hagerstown, Maryland. So kind of like the western part of Maryland. Again, I keep saying lucky, but I was lucky enough to stay on there as clinical. Got to do a mix of a lot of things clinical. Right after residency, I was still trained in critical care and emergency medicine and internal med and ambulatory care. So it's kind of like I backfill a lot of the specialists. So there might be 1 or 2 days I was in the ICU, and then I might be ambulatory for a day, and then I might be internal med for 2 days. And then if I staff the weekend, I might be in the ED for the weekend, and then have a day off or 2 days off, and then
Nice.
might be ambulatory again, and then
So
I might
you
be
were
internal
seeing
med. So
everything.
yeah, it was, I don't want to say continuation of residency, but I got to stay fresh with a lot of things. And about 6 months after that, I got to start a diabetes clinic, one of the family medicine practices associated with Meritus at the north end of Hagerstown. Did that for about 8 months, 9 months. Started, I loved it. I think it just started turning into something a little different than I had imagined. I think it was going more MTM based, and I wanted to be more traditional ambulatory care, seeing patients type thing. Then I got the job working in corrections, where you and I know each other from.
Good old corrections.
did that for about a year, and now I'm at the University of Maryland in Easton. So it's a small rural hospital, and I do clinical pharmacy work there. So that was a lot more than just educational stuff and where I'm from, but that's kind of my path of what's gotten me here.
And you also have a master's
I
as
do have I
well.
do have a master's. So I did that after getting my doctorate in pharmacy. Just because there are some things that I was interested in. I really love studies and stats. I'm the stats guy, if I was gonna let my ego slip out. That's what I love grilling students on, residents on, anything like that. So I thought I wanted to get a master's in biostatistics, and I thought maybe I want to be the guy on the back end doing the stats. Cannot do that, and it's way
No,
more difficult
too much.
than huge respect for anybody that does actual biostatistics. But I love finance, and I love the pharmacoeconomics, the cost benefit of stuff. And so I ended up getting a degree in the title of it's long. It's a master's in pharmaceutical outcomes and policy with a concentration in applied pharmacoeconomics. And I
That
finished that
that
last
is a
December.
long degree. I wonder who made that name up.
Yeah,
That's
it's
what.
too long. But I did that, like I said, after residency, after I'd gotten my PharmD, and did it while I was working. So it was a program design. It was with the University of Florida. It was a program designed for pharmacists, doctors, nurse practitioners, anybody that wants to deviate into some of these unique fields of healthcare and medicine. And ironically, they had a subspecialty or a concentration in medical writing and medical communications. I did not do that one.
No?
Okay. I was already working in it.
Okay.
I wanted the pharmacoeconomic stuff and yeah.
Okay. Nice. So then how did you get, well, first off, you said that it took you some time to figure out that you wanted to get into pharmacy. Yeah. You graduated at 28.
Yeah.
I graduated at 26.
Okay.
And I felt like I was a little, I felt like I was on the older end of the chain for all the graduates that were coming out. I think they were more like 23 was the average graduate year. But so what was it for you that made the light bulb go off? Like, I'm going to pursue pharmacy.
Yeah. So when I was 16, I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, and it was not juvenile. It was just full on rheumatoid arthritis. Caught on in 6 months. I mean, just going from walking normally, running around. I was in band and played Ultimate Frisbee, to shuffling my feet and not being able to walk, really. It's gotten to, and I'll fast forward, but now most people don't know I have rheumatoid arthritis unless I tell them. And that's because of drugs. I mean, I was put on Enbrel first, then Rinvoq. I had tried some other things too. But the first exposure to pharmacy was having that, going from, I don't want to say disabled, but really just
difficulty moving. You were on a track for being disabled.
Yeah, I mean, not being able to march in band, that's how bad my knees were. I could not march anymore. I was a section leader playing clarinet and played on the Ultimate Frisbee Club, to now shuffling, like trying to get out of bed to go to the bathroom that was maybe, I don't know, 10 yards away, was difficult. And that happened in 6 months. And then I start taking Enbrel. So giving myself an injection twice a week, and all of a sudden I'm back. I'm marching, I'm playing Ultimate Frisbee. And so to see that kind of stuff, where at 16, it's like, I don't know, I'm a human being, I'm big. I'm 160 pounds at that time, at 16, 17. I think it takes, you know, another person to bring me down, and it's this disease or whatever, it's rheumatoid arthritis. But then to imagine that just, I mean, that much medicine completely changes it. It was fascinating to me. I read a book after that called The Man Who Tasted Shapes. It's about a disorder called synesthesia. It was a neurology disorder or whatever. Just fascinating. So I knew, I think medical is my way of something. I have no idea what at this point. So I start community college right after high school. And so I say 16, but I was a senior at 16. So this is my last year in high school when all this stuff was going
genius.
On. No. I was put in school, you know, the cutoffs,
early?
The cutoffs and stuff.
They rushed you in before age cutoff?
My parents put me in private school because my birthday's in December. And the private school cutoff was the end of the year. Public school was like October or whatever it is. And so they did that for 3 years or a couple of years. And then I slipped into public school.
Okay.
So I was 16 turning 17 in high school. So anyways, it was in my senior year of high school when all that stuff happened. I go to community college. They do like this career day or whatever. Just like a bunch of little presentations of what you can do with different degrees, what schools offer what. And I heard, now I know, a professor at Shenandoah's pharmacy school talk about pharmacogenomics and how it's going to help people maybe not go through the trial and error phase of of drugs and after a new diagnosis. And I was like, well, I just went through that.
Yeah.
Just fascinated by it. Still at that point, have no idea what a pharmacist is. Embarrassingly. I couldn't tell you what a pharmacist does or what pharmacy techs are, what a pharmacy is. None of it. I was talking to a friend in one of my microbiology classes, pretty much saying this whole story. We just got to know each other. And he's like, you should get a job in a pharmacy. And he was a pharmacy tech and cut from then to today. And so that's pretty much how I got into pharmacy.
Nice. So based on a personal experience of medication saving your quality of life.
Yeah, literally.
I should say.
Yeah.
Because that's a pivotal age.
I think so. I think
16, 17. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then having a conversation with somebody who introduces this whole a new world to you. Mm-hmm. And then you decided to get into pharmacy school. What led you into the clinical route? Because there's different routes to take.
If I'm putting it bluntly, I had worked as a tech mm-hmm. for 5 years before pharmacy school and then for another 4 years. And mm-hmm. I could not do it. Just burnt out before graduation. That I knew I could do it. At the end of the day, it's a great salary. It's stressful work. That salary opens a lot of doors mm-hmm. to have a good quality of life and support my family. I would have done
when it. When you're not working.
But yeah. But I knew there was better for me. I liked the challenge. And the first time in pharmacy school where I felt like I had an advantage was when I started doing journal clubs and getting forced in that spot. And mm-hmm. again, not to sound egotistical, but there were moments where I was like, I think I know the study better than the preceptor.
Oh.
Just based off the questions they're asking.
Yeah.
And it was those moments where I was like, oh, hang on. I think this is my advantage. Mm-hmm. I'm not the best in class, in didactics or whatever. Yeah. I'm not the best at critical care. I'm not the best at this, but I think I'm better than most at interpreting a study and understanding what that stuff happens. Mm-hmm. And then I started building off of that. And that's how I knew, you know, during that time, I think residency is where I have to go. I think mm-hmm. clinical is where I have to go.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know exactly to do what mm-hmm. afterwards. Yeah. I think, but I at that point I was like, if I get to play with studies and interpret this stuff and discuss and talk about this stuff, working as a clinical pharmacist in a hospital,
yeah.
then I think that's what I have to do.
And applying it to decisions that you make for yeah. patients. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of, yeah, a mix of burnout and a mix of, I think this is just where my advantage is. I think this is where I'm meant to be.
And so fast forwarding, mm-hmm. where in this story do you stumble upon medical writing?
Residency. So the residency that I did, we had to co-teach some of the pharmacology classes at Frostburg University for their physician assistant program mm-hmm. For their pharmacology classes. And so we did a lot of the therapeutics. Mm-hmm. So I got to teach in a couple of those. And Maryland's state physician assistant association was doing a conference just on pharmacology. I guess they reached out to a lot of the schools, the mm-hmm. PA schools, to see about their professors teaching. And that led to Frostburg asking the pharmacy department if we wanted to do it and mm-hmm. just teach some CEs. So I'm building my teaching portfolio for the teaching certificate thing.
Yeah.
It was required at Meritus, but I love teaching, so I want to do that too. So I was like, yeah, more teaching opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to teach a CE on Crohn's and ulcerative colitis as one. And then rheumatoid arthritis. I was like, I could do that one.
Yeah,
I'll take that one on. So one was pre-recorded, and I think it was the rheumatoid one. And then one was a live presentation. Mm-hmm. Just did it because I wanted the experience and wanted to build that portfolio mm-hmm. of what I can do. At the end of it, I get a call from one of the coordinators of the event asking for my email because they wanted to send an Amazon gift card for doing it. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, cool. I get the email. It's a $300 gift card. And I'm like, nice. Wow, that's great. Yeah. And then immediately my second thought
for a resident, that's a big deal.
Yeah, it is. And that was the first thought was, oh, this is great. Thanks. Yeah. The second thought immediately was, hang on. There were more than just residents.
If I can get this with that.
Yeah, there were people who were not there just to build a portfolio. What did they get paid?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't ask to get paid, and I got $300 for doing two. Mm-hmm. What did they get paid?
Yeah.
And then just wheels started turning, started reading anything I could, trying to figure out, like, well, first, just how do you get paid to present? How do you get paid to present to CE? I just want to go to conferences and talk about this stuff. It's cool.
Yeah.
And then that led to, oh, these are medical writers. Oh, some of these people pay people just to build the presentation. Oh, what is this whole, and it took me, I don't know, maybe 6 months to even start to understand, just because it's overwhelming to understand where all the things you could get paid to do as a writer.
Yeah.
It's weird to even call it being a writer, because I think a writer is someone who writes books, but I mean, it's just almost anything you see, a continuing education document, a presentation, the script for a verbal one might be written by someone.
Yeah.
So that was really the start of just understanding, you know, oh my God, there's
a huge world
of, yeah. of this whole career that I never heard of, that pharmacists are right there meant to be doing it. So
like, yeah. this is what they do. They're yeah. not just signing up for opportunities. This is what they do this and focus what they on. Do.
Yeah.
So let's talk about it then.
Okay.
You kind of naturally segue us into there. Well, before we talk about what types of medical writing assignments there are, let's define like very clearly what a medical writer is for people who this is their first time listening to or coming up across what medical writing could be. So what does a medical writer do?
I think because the field is so large, my thought of what I want to define a medical writer is pretty simple. It's just someone writing literally anything in the medical field. I mean, it could be anyone. I think the RNs can be medical writers for, I mean, really anything that's needed to train or educate or teach someone anything about the medical space needs someone trained in the medical space to write it. So I think it's really just any of us in the healthcare field, or even, I guess, probably other scientists or whatever that know of the stuff can write about it. I think that's what a medical writer is, just writing about health, really.
Writing about anything that is contributing to the medical field with knowledge, content, guidance.
I think so, yeah.
And what spaces can that operate in? So, for example, you did a CE, and who was the audience for the CE?
Well, the first two CEs I did were physician assistants.
Physician's assistants, okay.
Pharmacology for physician assistants. And then I've done CEs for pharmacists and for techs. And then another CE that was supposed to be for pharmacists and techs. Mm-hmm. So it was, yeah, those were my personal ones. But I mean,
so it's for other healthcare professionals. Mm-hmm. And then there, and a CE means continuing education, by the way. So that can be in a presentation format, that can be in an online article format, that can come in different formats. Outside of CEs, there's also...
So a lot of the writing I do right now, I guess, would be like pre-grant proposal or grant writing. They use the term needs assessments, really just showing that, you know, there is a need for money to teach someone about this topic. Usually the grants that are coming aren't federal grants or state grants. They're grants from pharmaceutical companies or organizations that want to spread the word about some disease or some disorder or something, some new drug, some therapeutics. Within that, you know, if it's targeted towards pharmacists, we might be talking about what's the current landscape of treatments, what's the emerging landscape of treatments, what's the pharmacist's role in it. But there's going to be grants for teaching doctors, teaching nurses, teaching whoever. You know? And so a lot of that kind of work that's really focused towards educational stuff. There's also writing in medical affairs or regulatory affairs.
Okay.
So writing the submissions and proposals for new drug applications. If you're looking at medical devices that get approved by the FDA, I think it's the 510K form or something. K5 something K form. It's a 30, 40, 50 page document of evidence as for why this medical device is effective, safe, how it compares to others, all that stuff. It's a huge document that's written by medical writers.
And these are going to the FDA themselves to review, to determine whether approved or denied.
Yeah.
Okay.
So these are industry-based writers. So that you'd be working for the pharmaceutical company, or you might work for a company that is just medical writers that the pharmaceutical companies contract with to do those submissions. Maybe it's a small scale pharmaceutical company that can't pay to have their own in-house medical writing team. In the field of medical affairs, so you have people that are educating about new drugs that are coming out to the market or this kind of stuff. You have medical science liaisons that also might be medical writers because they're the ones writing all of the presentation material, the sales reps are going to be presenting. Or if the company is large enough, you might have medical writers that are writing those for both of them. So there's there's just so many avenues.
The list could go on.
Yeah, it's everything. Anything health related in industry and in healthcare, yeah. in education of healthcare can it has medical writers.
Mm-hmm. Like clinical guidelines.
Clinical guidelines.
Administrative yeah. guidelines.
Yes. Yeah.
So making policies and procedures.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, it's pretty vast.
It's huge. it's tough to condense as really to define it. It's tough. Yeah, it's tough. There's just so many things to do.
So what is your favorite area or format to currently write in right now?
It's the teaching and anything educational I want to write about.
The continuing education content?
Yeah, continuing education content I really like. The grant stuff is probably what I do the most, but and mm-hmm. it's fine. I think I enjoy that because a lot of it's rare disease stuff that I might not see in practice. And mm-hmm. so it's just cool yeah. to learn about it and get paid to learn yeah. about it. So that's cool. I love teaching. So and anything continuing education based, I really like presentation style. I really like that. And then if I was really going to nerd out anything finance, if I get to blend okay. finance with new drugs, so the pharmacoeconomic type stuff,
okay.
I'd love writing about that.
Nice. So what's been your favorite project so far? Like without, you know, disclosing proprietary
sure,
information,
sure.
but.
Probably what I'm writing right now. It's a project I'm working on. It's called an academic highlights paper. And it's just unique. And I think it's cool. So there's an area of like evidence-based medicine I've been struggling with of like, where is the place for anecdotes? Where's the place in healthcare for case series, case studies? Mm. When do you take the word of a clinician, an MD, that they've been seeing something that might be a trend, but there's no RCT
that's
to back it up.
Randomized control
yeah, sorry,
trial.
Randomized control
it's
trial.
It's a RCT.
It'd be very easy in the evidence-based landscape to shoot that trend, possible trend down, because uh-huh. You have no evidence for it. But it there should be a place for us to be able to identify a possible trend before yeah. we launch some multi-million dollar study to prove it. And with all the problems with trying that. And so this academic highlights paper feels like a good blend of taking, it's a round table discussion from a couple of doctors talking about the possible place of this one enzyme or this one thing, and that it may be affecting a couple of these diseases at the same time, and that we might not be focused on it. And so it's kind of a theory, a hypothesis of they think that they might be seeing it in practice, blending their discussion as quote-based writing and talking about what they're talking about and documenting it while also doing the evidence-based research and trying to support them and back them up. So I've created a draft of the evidence of where it could be. And then I'm going to meet with them in a couple of weeks and they're going to discuss it and add points and do that kind of stuff. And then the final draft, when that starts being built, it's going to be adding quotes from them and their personal thoughts and what they see in practice and that kind of stuff. So it's
cool.
It's different, but I think this is my favorite one I've gotten to work on.
And so where will that fit in the field of medicine? Like who does that serve and who does that benefit?
I think that's going to be more specific to MDs. It's going to be in a journal. So
okay.
as they're reading
physicians.
It. Yeah. I think for them it's the first time I'm doing it. So I'm still learning it as it happens. My assumption is if I'm a doctor reading this journal, reading this article, lets me kind of be like a fly on the wall of these high level physicians and their thoughts.
Yeah.
I think that's who it's going to benefit.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I didn't even know about that one. I'm yeah. still learning.
Yeah.
Okay. So as a pharmacist, we were looking at the stats earlier and we saw that 50% of medical writers have doctorate degrees in the sciences. Mm-hmm. That includes pharmacists in that number. And then we have about 32%. They hold master degrees in the sciences. As a pharmacist and And you already stated that you don't have to be a pharmacist to get into this field. But as a pharmacist, what do you think is unique about our training? Like, why does pharmacy background serve this field so well?
I have a couple ways I want to answer this one. Just the way I'm thinking about it. I think pharmacists are geared up and trained in pharmacy school for biostats, for reading studies. Can't speak for every pharmacy school, but
yeah,
at Shenandoah, I think I had a literature class every semester for 3 years, and I hated it until I got into Appy's and started realizing, oh, this is where I'm good at, and I need this. I wish I could go back and take those classes again, because I'm pretty sure I got like C's, maybe a B here or there. But I mean, we had so many literature classes. So I can speak from Shenandoah's standpoint, we're geared up and ready for evidence-based medicine, learning how to read a study, break down the study, not trust what the conclusion is saying, but build our own conclusion first.
Yeah.
And as long as you can take, if you can read a study like that and understand it and apply it, if you can then just take the next step and write it down, write what those thoughts are, what that means, to answer a question, then that's medical writing. Also think, I mean, pharmacists were trained on drugs, and the biggest area for medical writing is the pharmaceutical industry. We have new drugs coming out every couple of days. But I mean, between, if you're freelance medical writing, you might, I mean, you could be doing regulatory affairs and writing in industry and that kind of stuff. But I think most of the time you're probably doing educational writing. Mm-hmm. That's my experience so far. Mm-hmm. But pharmacists can be trained to write about the FDA submissions, can write any drug-related educational stuff. And I mean, I just, if the biggest employer of medical writers, or with the need for medical writers, it's not education-based, is the pharmaceutical industry, my assumption is I want a pharmacist medical writer.
Yeah.
And that's also a spot for PhDs too. If you have a PhD in pharmacology, maybe you did a PhD on some enzyme or whatever that the drug is going to be based off of. Well, yeah, I want you writing about this kind of stuff. But I think in general, just the general training pharmacists get, as long as you can just write and communicate, you're geared for it. So
our training and understanding how to read clinical studies.
Yeah.
The training, the being an expert in medications. What about the ability to communicate?
That's the biggest thing. That's what medical writing really is. It's just communications. And I think you can teach that. It's easier to teach how to, and the amount of tools available to be a better communicator, that's easier to learn than it is the nuances of pharmaceuticals. And, and I mean, just try, you can go online and see Instagram reels and TikToks of bad medical advice. It is very hard to actually learn and know what to do with that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And actual health information. And so you already have that training. I would much rather train someone to be a better communicator than try to teach them the pharmacy stuff.
So for those who are watching and they're like, well, I know how to, I understand medicine, I understand medications or whatever your health science background is, but they don't feel comfortable in their ability to write. That's teachable, is what you're saying. Oh, that shouldn't deter them.
Of course.
From getting into the field.
Yeah. There, there are bad writers all over the place. And there's, just because something is published in a journal doesn't mean it's good writing or it was a good study. I mean, once you know how to read a study and interpret stats, I'm sure you've read bad studies.
You're debunking. Well, the general public believes that if you have a fancy title or if you're in a fancy medical journal, that you are immediately like superior and like all knowing and you are all trustworthy.
Yeah.
And once you get in, you realize that's not the truth.
It's not the truth. There's a difference between I'm forgetting the
was it a specific analogy. Term?
Yeah, it's like educated does not mean intelligence is what I'm trying to say. So just because you have a doctorate degree does not mean you're smart.
I've never heard that before, but that's accurate.
Yeah. And I mean, the amount of studies I've read were, I mean, I was just reading one a couple of days ago. We're trying to get through the first paragraph. I'm like, oh, this is bad. You could have ran it through Grammarly and it would have been all red. And it was
Where was it on? What, like a medical journal?
Yeah.
Oh, goodness.
I didn't investigate the journal to see if it was like one of like the pay for journals or something like that. The data and the information in the study was great. It was a cool study, cool idea, but man.
They didn't communicate it well.
They should have gotten a medical writer that knew how to write. Because there's sometimes there's science, you know, like well, we were saying, you can teach communication. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people just aren't good at it. Either learn it or get someone to help you write it. Because, God, there's some bad studies. But anyways, you can teach that. They don't have to be bad. I was more shocked that there's no editor at the at the journal.
Nobody reviewed
give
this.
Some advice on like, hey, maybe you shouldn't say of the study. At the end of a sentence, when you've already mentioned, we're reading the study. Anyways, that's a deviation. But okay. Stuff like that. Yeah, you can learn how to be a better communicator.
Because it really is the art of telling a story.
Yeah.
Of telling a story well.
Yeah.
You have to really engage the audience. You have to be able to make it, break it down very clear. And you have to help them follow where you're going with things.
Yeah.
And if you cannot do that, you can have all the facts in there and you just don't know what you're taking away from it.
Yeah.
So that's what I like. I like storytelling. I'm studying storytelling.
Okay.
For that's not just written communication, that's verbal communication too. So I'm learning that the art of storytelling is very powerful, not just for comprehension, but also for retention as well. Mm. So I'm learning them. I'm dibbling and dabbling.
I think I've learned too. I think naturally I would rather be on a stage talking to students, talking to people about something different. Mm-hmm. I'd rather have a PowerPoint slide that has a picture and me talk about the picture for 5 minutes. And it's harder for me to write everything that the picture is talking about. I'd rather be mm-hmm. presenting it. So I've had to learn it. The what helped me obviously as I was going through this and having editors send me feedback and then reading the final product and seeing how they phrased things and realizing, this one paragraph that I wrote did seem pretty blocky. Did seem like you can feel where my thought process stopped at the end of this sentence. Mm-hmm. And then the next sentence was a clear, different thought process.
Yeah.
Whereas when I read their paragraph, the whole paragraph is smooth. And the story, the thought,
the transitions
flows through it. Well, how do they do that? They use that word there. Oh, that's how they started that sentence. Oh, they ended this sentence with this and went into that. Maybe I should do that. Borrow from people. Yeah. If you read an article that sounds really good, try to figure out why it sounds good and then just be like, okay, well, you know what? I'm gonna start starting my sentences like that when I'm talking mm-hmm. that way. You know, it doesn't have to be something you create or come up with yourself. Mm-hmm. I think you can borrow from other people.
Yeah, so you're studying the technique of writing as well from other writers.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm doing now. I'm doing a lot of that because I'm early in my medical writing journey. So I am doing a lot of studying of, I see how they phrase that. I like that. Like I should adjust my sentence to be a little bit more eloquent. Mm-hmm. Eloquent and sophisticated. Because I'll go back to my earlier sentence and it's just like the cat in the hat. Like it will just be very like
I'll tell you the,
matter of fact.
The my biggest pet peeve of writing, and it is in every journal. I think it's a cultural thing where people are trying to sound smarter. Not even that, because that's rude to say.
No, but that's
they're,
real.
They're
that's
not,
real.
They're not telling the story.
They're so focused on sounding smart. They're not.
And every sentence starts with therefore, comma, additionally, comma, however, comma. It's like just say the sentence. You don't need to break it up because that what feels to me is like that's the breaking in your mind trying mm-hmm. to say what's the next thing. Just say the story.
Yeah.
Most of their sentences would sound still just fine, better if you just remove the
certain words.
Therefore. Without or whatever, just remove it. Get rid of that stuff, and it's every journal. And so then you have students who are trying to emulate mm-hmm. on how to write because they're the first times they're writing an article trying to get published. They start writing like that, and it's like, please don't. Just tell the story of what you're doing. It would sound so much better.
Yeah. So that's very helpful for people to know because, fortunately, in the company that you introduced me to, there is an editor that is not just accepting what goes through and taking face value. They read, they send it back with recommendations and all the marked changes and comments on the paper. And it helps you. Well, I know it's helping me. It's actually training me as I'm doing it. And to me, that's monumental. And that's really what drew me to the company.
Has that been a learning curve for you? Because I'll tell you, the first time I worked with an editor, the impulse to be defensive and say, no, that is my work. That was good. And then you see the finished product. You're like, you know what? Actually, yeah, you were right. That probably took me months.
No, actually. But I think that's my personality.
Yeah, in medicine. That might be my personality. I'm very protective of my work.
So for example, I think that's a quick detour. Story time. For example, I'm talking with my cousin who is telling me that she is using doxepin for anxiety treatment.
Okay.
And see your face?
I'm just thinking.
See your face right now? We're going to make sure the camera zooms up on that. I had the same. My face was kind of more like.
Just inquisitive. Just curious.
What? So she did her research online about her condition and brought it in to the doctor and said, can I try this? And the doctor was like, probably did their own Google search, was like, okay, it's used to treat it, so let me just pop it on. All right. That's what it was giving. And that's my interpretation of how that even happened.
Okay.
Because apparently the provider wasn't even aware that it was used for that until the patient, my cousin, brought it to her attention.
Yeah.
Anywho, where was I going with this story? I'm bringing it back. Okay, so she tells me that she's using doxepin for anxiety. And I'm like, I have never, ever, ever, ever seen doxepin used for anxiety. I haven't been practicing for like 10, 15 years, but I've been out here for a little while. Yeah. I have yet to see that.
Yeah.
And I've seen the disease state a lot. Where are we doing this at? She's like, well, it's used for anxiety. That's what and I'm like, are you sure? I don't think it treats anxiety. But I was like, but I don't want to just say it's not. Let me look.
Right.
I look and it's used for anxiety. Mm. It actually has use for anxiety. Now, there's a whole other conversation of like, is that the best agent that we should be using? Right. That's a different conversation. I didn't completely close off to the fact that this could never be the case just because I haven't seen it before.
Yeah.
So the purpose of that whole detour story was that's just kind of how I approach medicine, because there's so much information to learn and it's so hard to remember all of it. But even if I hear something from a patient that sounds very odd, like sometimes I'll be on the other screen, like looking into what they're saying to
how quick are you to agree to absolute yeses, absolute nos? Versus possibility of something.
If it is not like 100% concrete knowledge that I know that for a fact is not accurate, like then I am open to the idea that I could be wrong and there could be some benefit here.
Yeah.
But I'm the same way. I'm even more so like that in areas that I am coming into new territory for me.
Yeah.
So I like writing, but I never had like a structured writing system like this with medical writing where someone's now an editor of my work. Mm-hmm. So I kind of went into it intentionally with the like, I'm going to give you my best shot, my best job, but I do know I have a safety net. And I'm actually looking forward to like where I need to improve.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the best way to approach having someone who's going to edit your work. I think the areas of my personality that are going to be defensive is when it's something that I know I'm very good at, such as dissecting a study. And then I'm told we don't need that information in there.
Oh, well, is irritating that is irritating. Like you did a bunch of work and you like, you think this sounds great. Yep. And they're like, nah, take this out.
That doesn't fit the direction of the article. But I was like, but it could.
It's like, no.
I want to say it, but it could, no. But I'll just, but, yeah, I think you're right. Okay.
I'll remove it. I did that. I spent probably 10 hours on something for one of the assignments, and the whole thing got, like, the whole section got scrapped.
That sucks.
I cried real tears for them. I was like, oh no.
Yeah.
But that was a very hard lesson for me to learn.
Yeah.
And it was like, she asked the question that if I would have asked myself that first, I wouldn't have gone down that rabbit hole. Like, I didn't
that's a learning curve too, especially, I mean, I think you've been writing for about 5-6 months.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's like, yeah. Yeah, a couple of years, you know, to ask those kind of questions.
Yeah.
Or even just now when that next thing happens, you don't even have to ask the question. You just know to ask yourself the question.
She posed a question and she wasn't wrong. And I was like, oh man, like I didn't have my brain just like saw something and ran with it. Yeah. And then I was doing way more than I needed to.
Yeah.
So that part was, but that was on me.
I spent on one article, very similar to what you just said. I was talking about emerging treatments.
Mm-hmm.
And I love reading about pharmaceutical companies and their phase 1-2 trials and all these new investigational stuff. And so from what the client had sent was about these couple of these drugs that are in phase 3, very close to FDA approval,
mm-hmm.
or submitting the NDA. And I had found like 5 other phase 2 candidates. And I didn't ask if I should include them. I just wrote about them. And it was probably a page and a half of information about these, but all gone. Did not make the final cut of the article. I should have just said,
I can see that.
Does the client want phase 2 drugs too? I could have just asked that. I didn't. I just stuck. I was like, these are fascinating. And just kept writing about them. It's
too risky. The phase 2s are too risky.
Yeah. So I've done that.
Well, it's a learning curve. And then I think the best lessons are the lessons you learn the hard way.
The hard ones.
Those are the ones you don't forget, and you're not making those mistakes ever again.
Yeah.
Man, so we talked about the different formats that you have within medical writing. Mm-hmm. Let's do a little bit of, let's talk about the different ways that you can be within the medical writing space. So you have freelance work.
Yeah.
And then you can do that full time or part time, mm-hmm. however you choose. Mm-hmm. And then you also can literally make medical writing your 40-hour day-to-day employee-based work. So what would you say are the pros and cons of each choice?
I'm gonna steal some numbers and like stats and recommendations from the American Medical Writers Association. That's just a quick plug.
Sound like a pharmacist right now. Go ahead.
That is the place to go if you want to learn how to be a medical writer. They have resources and that kind of stuff. They have a career page and stuff like that, but they also have like modules you can learn from. Some of them are free, some of them you pay for. But I learned a lot from them. I think Medical Writers Association, the AMWA.
Okay.
So they come out with like a survey every year, like a compensation survey every year. And I think this is just my approach to trying to look, when I was looking at medical writing and when I was approached with the same question of, should I freelance this or should I look at leaving clinical pharmacy and becoming a medical writer as my career? Okay. The salaries are about the same. But it's what do you have to pay for is thinking about 40 hours a week.
Do you mean, a 40-hour freelancer and a 40-hour employee?
Yes.
Okay.
The take home is going to be about the same. I think based off their numbers, this was like the 2015 or 2019 salary survey. I think there's a 2023 or 2024 one. I haven't looked at that one yet. I think it's being finalized or whatever. But the take home for a freelancer was roughly like $150,000 a year. If you're doing about 40, 50 hours a week, it's a lot. It's like a lot of money. When you're looking at a pharmacist salary and you're looking at that, this is a good shift. This is comparable, depending on what area of pharmacy you work in, could be more. Mm-hmm. But if you're a full-time freelancer, 40, 50 hours a week, you're finding your own clients. You have to do client relations. You do not have health insurance. You have to pay taxes. You're running a business. It is a business. But it's a business with massive upscale. Maybe you hire another writer. Maybe you, if you're doing it as a business, you can be the sole proprietor, or you can now hire someone. Maybe you, there's a pharmacist, it's a friend of yours, an old colleague that wants to learn it, and you can offload 10 hours of work to them. And maybe there's a second one, whatever. There's growth potential with that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the base of it, if the average compensation for the freelancer on that survey was about $150,000 a year, working full-time equivalent hours, and you're not looking at growth potential, you have taxes from that, you have to pay for health insurance, you have to pay for other things.
Yeah.
The average salary of a medical writer, that's like a full-time employee.
A W-2
I think employee. Was about $110,000 a year. But that's also relative to the type of writing you do. I think regulatory affairs pays more. So if you're the people writing like the new drug applications, the medical device applications, I think that area makes more as a medical writer.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I think educational writing is one of the lowest paying ones.
Isn't it always?
Yeah.
Why doesn't the world like academia?
Yeah. But then if you want to be a medical or have aspects of medical writing in your career, medical science liaisons do medical writing or some portion of it.
And they make that.
They make a ton of money.
Gosh, money, is, honey.
Yeah. They make a ton of money. So, but medical writers in that sense, maybe you're writing the documents for the sales team and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that pays, but maybe that pays $140, $150. And then you get the benefits of being in industry, the health insurance benefits, whatever, the bonus mm-hmm. structure. So it's tough to say exactly how much breaking down into each individual pocket. But then the other piece of advice from the Medical Writing Association is that it can be difficult to just start as a freelancer. I think that's comparative to a lot of things, and not just medical writing, but just freelancing in general.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have a portfolio of work, why is someone going to hire you?
Right.
So trying to get that first client can be tough.
Yeah.
There are ways around it, or not ways around it, but there's ways you can build a portfolio without before you get a client. I mean, it's just writing, just write stuff. But so it can be tough going that avenue. I don't really know if there's a lot of part-time opportunities or anything like that. But I mean, just looking
at I would say the company we work for is part-time.
No, I agree. The company we fell into is unique to pharmacists. It only hires pharmacists, and there's not many of us in there. I'm lucky.
So are you saying, and this is me also learning, are you saying that that is a rare commodity in the medical writing space?
I think so. Okay. Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know.
I feel lucky to found, I mean, within just a couple of months. Because I've been doing this for about 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I have gotten other clients myself to do other styles of writing. And it's tough. I mean, the amount of stuff you have to do client relation wise, keeping up with payments and communication while also working another full-time job. Whereas the company that we both write for, the assignments just get sent to us. I don't have to talk to
them. And they just ask for a minimum of one project a month, I believe.
Yeah. And so it's, I can take on more stuff if the more stuff's available. Bare minimum, I'm doing one a month.
Mm-hmm.
The assignments just get sent to me. I write them, I send them, I get paid later. It's all good.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's very smooth. But so if you're starting medical writing, do you find a company like that that's freelance as well? Do you work full-time hours as an employee somewhere else? Or do you try to be the person finding their own clients? I don't think there's a wrong answer in those. Each one of them is going to be difficult. Are you able to, on your CV when applying for a full-time job, highlight your transferable skills to be a medical writer?
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you're an RN, a PharmD, an MD, whichever, to get that job,
mm-hmm.
go for it. But that's a hurdle too, just as it is a hurdle trying to find your first contract or your first client,
yeah.
or whichever. So I none of them's wrong. I think it really boils down to what's your personality, what's your desired writing type, and what are you meant to do? Maybe if someone has a great personality, I think go for trying to find your own clients. Do
yeah.
it. That's awesome.
The extrovert who can go out and network and socialize.
Because the upside potential on that is insane.
Mm-hmm.
If we're just thinking about the compensation of the money, you can make great money if you can find the clients and really do it. Go for
mm-hmm.
it. I like where I'm at with the assignments get sent to me. I don't have to do the client relations stuff.
Yeah.
I have a family. I have a full-time job. I get the stuff sent to me. I write it. I send it. It's chill. I like that.
So... And we talked about this before, and you said it's about finding your why. Like if somebody asked you directly, like which one they wanted to get into, your response would be based on understanding why they want to get into medical writing in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, my why was I missed teaching. I want to be I needed an outlet to teach.
Mm-hmm.
My wife can only take in so much information of me boring her and just lecturing about drugs every day.
Yeah.
There has to be some outlet. Mm-hmm. And I'm not teaching in a pharmacy school. I still don't know how to get presentation stuff. So we got to talk later more because I want those too.
Oh, yeah.
But medical writing just seemed like a great way just to get thoughts out, to get a little money while learning about cool diseases and, mm-hmm. and writing. I don't think, like thinking of myself in high school and in college and stuff, that I would have been a writer or consider myself a medical writer. Mm-hmm. Said maybe at the time I don't enjoy writing or didn't mm-hmm. at the time. I've learned to like writing because it serves the outlet of I get to talk about this stuff. Mm-hmm. I get to think about this stuff. So that was my why. But someone yeah. else might love writing and that might be, that's what they want to shift their career to. That's your why, go for it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's definitely person specific.
And then what other opportunities or doors could it open within the field of medicine just by being in this space?
I mean, medical affairs alone, there's so many doors. Regulatory affairs, medical affairs, you're going into industry, you want to go into, what was I saying? Industry, yeah. And my brain paused for a second.
Medical affairs, define medical affairs.
Yeah.
You've been saying that a lot.
We have. So we said regulatory affairs was like FDA approvals, that kind of stuff. Medical affairs is really just talking new drugs coming out to the market, discussing those drugs, disseminating information about new drugs or old drugs. Really, medical affairs is drug information and client relations is, okay. I think, in my mind, where it really boils down to. A lot of medical affairs you're going to be seeing in pharmaceutical companies. You can kind of consider sales reps as part of medical affairs, but they're going to put that as its own sales team, as mm-hmm. its thing. But they're also disseminating information about new products. That's medical affairs to me, is mm-hmm. the promotion and the education of new products or old products, if there's stuff. But that's it to me. Okay.
So they can segue into these industry spaces
yeah,
relatively easy.
There's that. There's regulatory affairs. But if I'm thinking as a pharmacist too, there's drug information in hospitals. Now, there are PGY2s, so second year residencies in drug information. But I can't see why, if you're a pharmacist that didn't do a residency, but you've been medical writing for a couple of years, that you wouldn't qualify to be a drug information specialist mm-hmm. in a hospital. You have like companies like Lexicomp, UpToDate, all those things. Mm-hmm. That's medical writing too, I imagine.
It is. Someone has to write those pages.
Yeah. So I imagine if you're doing freelance for a couple of years and then that pops up and you want to transition full time, I can't imagine you wouldn't qualify and that kind of door wouldn't open to now be the person who's writing the references that everybody practices off of. I mean, mm-hmm. I think the amount of doors that are potentially opened is crazy. And then you have like the social media doctors and stuff.
The social media
like doctor. Dr. Ids and all of them. Like maybe that's the next thing. I don't know. Those doors can open. You can be the next personality or whatever.
I'm trying to be a social media pharmacist. That's my next gym. I'm a YouTube pharmacist now. So those are the opportunities that can come from it. And just to, I do want to circle back to this because you touched on it, but then you kept moving. For somebody, we said that it's hard to break into the space without a portfolio in place to show people your previous writing so that they're incentivized to bring you on the team. So how can someone do that? You said you can sit down and write, but let's mm-hmm. give them a little bit more mm-hmm. direction into what that looks like.
Yeah. So I did say that there were hurdles to face in every single one. And I guess at the same time I said that, I might contradict myself in that I would argue that medical writing and writing in general is one of the only fields that has no gatekeepers. So we know as pharmacists, the difference between clinical and non-clinical, which I think is those terms are starting to die a little bit. I think back in the 80s and 90s when PharmDs weren't required, there was a clear separation between, the PharmDs are clinical. Oh, the people who didn't get their doctorates in pharmacy, they're not clinical. Those are the retail people. I think that's gone or starting to really go away because I think anybody who is a PharmD has the foundation to become clinical. Mm-hmm. There is a difference between clinical-based work and operations-based work, and I think that's fair to understand the differences. But we know as pharmacists, the hurdle difference or not hurdle difference, the gatekeeping aspect of trying to get into hospital or clinical work if you didn't do a residency.
That is tough.
It's not impossible. You might have to maybe go to a hospital that's more rural, maybe there, where it's less competition to get in. Mm-hmm. You have to find ways to still be growing as a pharmacist that allows you to have transferable skills to get in. Mm-hmm. It is definitely more difficult, though. And unfortunately, that's how it is. But that is a gatekeeping aspect. I don't think that exists with writing and medical writing. Open a Google Doc. Start writing. It costs $15 a month to own a website. Start putting articles on a website.
What subscription do you have?
Well, I mean, just a basic.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, I keep moving and my mic keeps falling off.
I'm trying to know where you get this $15 website from. What? I'm joking.
I have Bluehost.
Oh, Bluehost? No.
It's a pretty big hosting software or hosting company.
See, I use Bluehost. I didn't know that.
So a website domain is like $12. I'm awful with this microphone. Let me try again.
There we go.
I'm not going to move.
It's because your arm is resting on the cord piece. Give it a little bit more leeway. There you go.
Okay. So a website domain is like $12 and then hosting it maybe $10-$15 a month. And you have your own website. Spend the time to learn how to build a website. You don't have to pay anybody for it. Just write and just put articles on there. Who cares if it looks like crap at the start? Spend time and just do it. Start a Substack. It's free. And just put articles out there. Social media. Just write about it. If you have friends on social media, just tell people, hey, I'm going to start writing about this stuff. Please follow it. Please like it, whatever. Mm-hmm. You have friends that support you. Now, all of a sudden, after a couple months, how many articles do you have on LinkedIn or Substack or your own website or whichever? And you've built a portfolio. And now if you're applying for a freelance thing or you're applying for an actual job, you have links to send them to. Hey, I wrote about this art or this topic a couple of times. Mm-hmm. I know you're looking for a freelance writer to write about this. Mm-hmm. Here's my work on it. And even if you're nervous to start your own website or Substack or do the social media thing, just write. If you really are motivated to be a writer, just open a Google Doc or Microsoft Word and just write. Just get your thoughts down. And I think the analysis paralysis is the worst thing. And just write. Just write. Yeah. There's no reason. I mean, if you don't have a computer, don't do pen and paper. That's probably not getting a job. That's not building a portfolio. But write on a Google Doc, write on Word. There's so many avenues, and that is going to be building your portfolio. So there's no one telling you can't do it.
You don't have to wait for the opportunity for someone to give you a first chance at writing.
No.
Start it on your own.
Yeah.
Get good at it by just doing it. If you have people in your life who can edit and review before you post it online, which I do encourage.
Yeah, definitely do that. You still want to be putting your best foot forward.
Put your best foot forward. Ask someone to read through, see what it sounds like. Mm-hmm. And then,
also,
that's really good advice.
On that, though, don't try to be the writer or the person or the voice that you want to be in 5 years. Because I've looked back at those first articles that I've wrote and I thought they were great. They're terrible. They're awful drafts. But at the time, I thought they were. It was the best I could do. Mm-hmm. But now I look back and I'm like, that's awful. So, edit it. Yeah. Make it try to be a good voice. But also, don't be worried if 6 months from now you look back and you're like, God, what was I thinking?
Yeah.
You're going to get better.
Yeah.
But you only get better by doing it, right?
Yeah.
There was something else I was thinking about that, but I forgot.
That's so true. I also had a thought while you were talking, and then it just flew out the window. I swear I have to catch them in the air like this, it's gone.
I got it. So I don't know if I told you this when you were first interested in medical writing, and I might have had the same rant to you about just write, open a Google Doc, whichever.
You did
write.
Give me that advice, yeah.
But there was one piece to that, and that if you're someone working in the medical field, and there's ever a time you have a question, and you have to look something up, like, why are they prescribing this drug? Or why are they doing this for? And you look it up. That question can be an article. That mm-hmm. can be a topic to write about. And so if you're at work and you're trying to figure out, I want to break into this, but I don't have time, just write down on your phone real quick in a notes app or whatever, I want to write about this question. And then just go home and write about it for an hour.
So you're speaking upon now is if someone's asking, well, how do I know what to write about?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So... Yeah. With the whole analysis paralysis and how do I start writing? When do I start writing? What do I write about? If you're working in the medical field, you are faced with so many things to write about and so many potential topics. Mm-hmm. Don't wait for someone to ask you to write about it. Just write about it and then find a way to get it out there, either social media, your own website, whichever. They're all super easy.
So what about our new generations who might be saying, I don't need to write. I'm going to chat GPT it.
Oh, geez.
I'm just going to chat GPT and send it out. What would you say?
I'm opinionated about it.
Well, let's answer that. And then let's actually talk about AI and its current impact, and then the foreseen impact that it may have in the space of medical writing. But let's just, for the person who's saying, well, why do I have to put in the time to build this skill mm-hmm. when I can just let AI do it for me? What would your response be to that?
I am not convinced that AI will ever be effective communicators. AI will still just be what we put into it. So there still needs to be us to generate the new information. Right now there is no AI. So to define artificial intelligence, we don't have those. We don't have that. That doesn't exist. If that exists, we're done. From a social perspective.
Well they're saying ChatGPT and those platforms are AI.
I'm convinced they're language models. I think we're using the wrong term when we say AI. It's kind of like when organic and organic foods became the term. And then organic chemists were like, well, hang on. You don't ever really eat inorganic foods. So organic got the moniker for health and maybe pesticide-free and that kind of stuff. But really, if you eat celery, it's organic. Whether it has the organic label on it or not, it's an organic food. I think the same thing's happening with AI, where ChatGPT specifically is a very good language model. It doesn't really know what it's saying. It's very good at stringing together characters that seem coherent when we read it. It also doesn't generate its own new information. It generates those characters and those string of characters based off the information that's available online and where the information we fed it. Mm-hmm. So then you're leaving it open for other issues, but the biggest issue I'm concerned with is bias. Who and what team put together the rules that the program chooses what string of characters it's going to put out. And then if that bias exists, let's say it's relevant to medical writing. Let's say there's a ChatGPT equivalent for healthcare mm-hmm. that we're supposed to be using now for, instead of Google, looking something up on UpToDate or Lexicomp, we have to ask this program. But what if that program is, what if the company that's feeding information to that in that program had a bad deal with Pfizer? Now, all of a sudden, all of Pfizer's studies and Pfizer's funded studies are no longer in there. Well, that's not good healthcare. That's not good evidence-based medicine. I think there's always going to be a need for us to write and read studies and break stuff down. And I'm not convinced. I think there's too much nuance in how we interpret a study and how we apply information like that into actual practice, and then how we teach healthcare practitioners how to do that. I think there's too much nuance in just those three spots that a language model wouldn't be able to do.
So it's still relying on humans to give it the information it knows.
Yeah.
And if there is a brand new study that hasn't even been published yet, it's still stuck on clinicaltrials.gov. Mm-hmm. And you might need to include that in your article.
Yeah.
You missed it with ChatGPT.
Yeah.
Because it didn't have that information.
Yeah. If you don't pay for ChatGPT, I think ChatGPT is, the information is up to 2021 or 2022, and you have to pay for ChatGPT for it to be up to date. And every once in a while, they roll out updates that adds in new information. So it's still behind. When you're looking at something that's very nuanced to what medical writing is, I think that's why medical writing is a thing, is that most of the time the assignments are nuanced questions that you have to investigate.
And a lot of them are novel questions.
Yeah.
Like
there is no one study that in the years I've done it, there's never been one study that I have found that perfectly answers the question, and because they are weird questions. So, I mean, the amount that we have to cite just dozens of stuff. Mm-hmm. But if there's real AI, I'm not concerned about medical writing. I'd be concerned about every other aspect of life, if real AI becomes a thing.
I hope I still have a job.
I hope, yeah.
Man. Okay,
so turn into a Will Smith movie.
iRobot. Yeah. You kind of did answer. You kind of hit everything.
Yeah, sorry.
It was fine. So basically, the short answer is don't do that.
I'm not worried about it.
Don't you dare.
The positive, though, I think is it's a great tool. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we could call Grammarly an AI software or a program. Mm-hmm. That's a tool. It helps me rephrase sentences. It's like a very good Microsoft Word editor. You know, mm-hmm. it based on how I want to write, you can tell Grammarly, I want to write scientifically on this section, or I want emotion in this section, and it'll help you rephrase things to be smarter.
I don't know, you could do that with Grammarly. I know you could do that with ChatGPT.
And so same thing with ChatGPT. I love using ChatGPT to come up with titles for presentations or an article. Mm-hmm. I used to be like, I'm going to write about XYZ and the audience is here, help me come up with titles. And it'll print out titles, and I'll never copy and paste one because that might be an actual word for word title from someone else. But mm-hmm. maybe, you know what? I like how they use these first two words here, like decoding something. I like that.
Yeah.
Oh, I like how it said pharmacology. I'm going to take that too. I'm going to think decoding. I don't like this second word. And it's like having a smart friend in the room that you're bouncing ideas off of. But you're not plagiarizing that smart friend.
That's a really good analogy.
That's my way to use it, at least.
Yeah, that's a really good analogy. I even will use it to help me come up with kind of like a background of information.
Yeah.
Just to let me know where I need to start going and doing more. What was it I'm looking for? Evidence-based. Like,
yeah, digging.
Getting into more reputable resources. But it gives me a good starting place.
Yeah, really helps with just the outline. And for me, the outline is usually the hardest part of just like, well, how am I going to start? I have this mountain of information, this mountain of a task that I have mm-hmm. to do. How do I even start? And it's very good at just giving you kind of the little push to start. I like it that way.
Yeah. So it has benefit, but it shouldn't be replacing us and we shouldn't be swapping it out. Do they have ways to tell if somebody is just copy pasting?
I don't know. I imagine my assumption is that unless you're using like the highest end ChatGPT or maybe there's software that's not publicly available that is very good at sounding human. I imagine that exists, but there's got to be sentence structure or wording choices that don't sound great mm-hmm. or sound coherent as a human would write. And if it's just copy and pasted and you didn't edit what was there, I think you could pick it up. I don't know if there's software that could tell if it was produced by ChatGPT.
I don't know that some schools are using, there's something out there because some schools are using it to catch students who aren't writing their own papers anymore. Mm. And there's a way that they can like check whether their work was.
Well, I know there's been like that plagiarism software to see like how much is similar to something else. So I guess if ChatGPT, with that one, if like ChatGPT is just straight up taking sentences from some other article.
Yeah.
But I bet there is some other type of software that just said this came from ChatGPT.
It's very unknown, so you have to tread very lightly.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's so dope. Hmm. That like the possibilities that it can bring, but it also I think is going to weaken people as well.
I think so.
I think skill sets are going to be lost with its dependence. The same way I used to be better at math in high school than I am now.
Mental math. Yeah.
Like I used to actually, at one point I was good with like, I can do numbers in my head mm-hmm. and now I can't, like it's calculator all day and just terrible. And I know that's a lost skill because I just stopped using the muscle. So you lose it.
Right. And I think the same thing could happen with writing.
Yeah.
If you forget, I mean, well, not even forget, you just stop doing it. It's going to be difficult to, that's how I did this sentence structure. That's mm-hmm. Yeah. Same thing.
And you kind of set my expectations in the beginning for it. For example, like one of the assignments that we have, like a needs assessment assignment, you told me that in the beginning, it would take you maybe 30 to 40 hours to do one of them. And now you're at a place where you're doing it in 8 or less.
Maybe 8 to 10 hours. I think like 6 to 8 hours is probably just for the information. And then probably 2-ish hours, 3 hours for editing. But that also, not just editing, but like a title, a table here and like kind of like the fine tuning of mm-hmm. everything, making sure my references are good. And it also depends on, is it a subject I'm knowledgeable on? If you send me a diabetes something, 5 hours, I probably already have the sources ready mm-hmm. and could pump it up. But if it's some like geographic atrophy or some disease, I have no idea what mm-hmm. it is. It's probably gonna take longer.
Yeah.
Not even probably, it will take longer. Yeah.
But it was really good to set my expectations because I was/am taking a long time mm-hmm. just doing them. And it was like, is this what it's going to be like forever? And so it's repetition makes you more efficient and not, you're just not faster. You're better.
Yeah.
Like you said, your revisions were significantly, each time they were coming back less and less.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And I think actually now, I haven't thought about this before, but that might be why or play a part in why it's difficult to land a freelance job at the start. Because a lot of freelance jobs will pay per hour, or they'll either pay per hour or they'll have a set fee for the project. Mm-hmm. And so if you're a brand new writer, they don't know how long it's going to take you to do this. And maybe they have an expectation that this should be a 12-hour project, but it takes you 30 hours. As a client, you don't want to be billed for 30 hours for something that you thought was going to be 12 hours billable.
Yeah.
And so at the start, you will lose clients. If you're trying to go that freelance route to grab your own clients instead of working for a company that allows freelance work, you will lose clients mm-hmm. if you're overbilling for them mm-hmm. Or overbilling for work. And so as you're doing that client relations, and you're trying to land these contracts, these jobs, it might be better to set expectations of total compensation of the project versus hour-based. And communication of this is how long we expect it to take, that kind of stuff. Because and that might not just be a new writer thing too, but just skill-based. If I'm used to writing this type of thing over here and I got a project for this over here that's a different style, mm-hmm. that could take me longer because I have to learn the style first. And do you bill for that? Do you not? Is there an expectation of what they think it should be for? So I think that will play a role in how you land your first job too. Yeah, just a random thought. I don't think I've thought about that.
That's really helpful for people who are looking to get into the work so that they're not just writing 3 articles on their own and they're like, well, the Pharmacy Pathways video said I can write a couple and then be ready to go. And then now they're losing clients. They're having a bad reputation now because they're charging way too much and the quality is not even that good because it takes time to get there. So when would somebody know when they're ready to be a freelancer without the supervision of an editor?
That's a good question. I think everybody should have an editor. Editors are great. But I mean, I think most of the, when you're getting a client like that, and if you're really going the freelance route, a lot of times built into the contracts, they'll have like an X amount of revisions that they'll send back to you before the final draft.
Okay, so they do they'll have an editor on their end.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. And they'll, like in whatever contract, it'll say, you know, we're allowed 2 revisions.
Okay.
So, you know, here's the final draft. And then they'll look at it and they'll send back, you know, marked up. These are the things we like. These are things we don't like or whatever. And you can cut down on that, the amount of revisions, by just having good communication with whatever client you're having. So as you're writing it, you're unsure, oh, do they want this section to go in this direction or this direction? Just send them an email, text, call, talk to them.
Yeah.
And figure out what direction do you want to go. Because if it's the wrong direction and you send it as the final draft, they're going to crush that in one of those revisions. So it's a lot of that kind of stuff, just client relations stuff. But as far as knowing when you're ready to I think that it's very personal on just how quickly you're grabbing onto writing style, how efficient you are. And yeah, it's very person dependent, I think. And as you're doing it, obviously you'll get faster and more efficient and that kind of stuff. But I think it's things to be mindful of as far as billing and compensation and then expected compensation too. Because if a project I'm writing for, let's say it's $1,000 and I think it's going to take me 25 hours to do it. So now I'm looking at 40 an hour, but it ends up taking me 38 hours. That sucks from a compensation standpoint.
Yeah.
I was expecting somewhat of one rate and now all of a sudden it's almost halved. And it's maybe there's other clients I was hoping to work for that week or whatever. You know, there's things like that you really have to be mindful of. But I think that's more of just freelance work in general, and not necessarily just writing, but just being a good freelancer.
And from that, you're making me want to ask this question, because I just want our audience to have all the knowledge they need. So let me start here. A lot of times we come out with our fancy degrees, and we're saying, I'm not getting paid X amount of hour. Mm-hmm. I have a doctorate. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not doing that. I make XYZ. I can make this money over here. So when does someone have to humble themselves and take something that, yes, you're getting paid less per hour. Yes, a doctorate typically would be making more than this for this mm-hmm. project. But when is it a wise decision to put pride aside and be humble and to strategically take projects that they're making probably half of what they would earn somewhere yeah. else, or even less, you know, more than.
Yeah. My mindset when I started it was kind of like residency. So we know what an average pharmacist salary is, and the average resident salary is about 45,000. This is about a third of what we'd expect. But I knew going into residency, it's not for the money. I'm doing it to learn all these skills so that I can do a different type of pharmacy job.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the same mindset as I went into writing, is that this is going to take a lot of time, but I'm learning how to do this. If I'm still in this situation where it's taking a lot of time after like a year, then maybe I need to figure out, are there things I'm doing that aren't efficient enough? Should I be asking questions to the editor or some senior writer saying, how do you approach this kind of stuff? I'm finding that it's taking me 10 hours to do this part.
Mm-hmm.
How long does it take you, and how do you do it, and why?
Mm-hmm.
And still learning, but I think, you know, for me at least, the compensation part, years, I'm learning. So I have to learn these skills. So I'm kind of getting paid to learn. So that's part of the compensation piece. If I'm thinking of from like a W-2 perspective, like working as a full-time employee,
mm-hmm.
I think I've seen some job postings where just like an entry-level medical writer at like a pharmaceutical company or some other type of industry type writing company. It's been like, I've seen them between 80 and 105,000.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, they're hiring master's degrees, PharmDs, PhDs. So the salary is high, but if I'm thinking as a pharmacist, that's a pay cut.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm convinced I want to be a medical writer, do I take that job, kind of like a residency,
mm-hmm.
and sacrifice that part of my salary, but knowing I'm going to be learning a lot, I'm going to be getting a ton of industry experience, a ton of writing experience.
Mm-hmm.
Senior medical writers can, mm-hmm. I've seen job postings in the 150s and 180s. Or do you become a director of the medical writing? I mean,
mm-hmm.
the growth yeah. potential of taking that sacrifice is great. Just like yeah. the growth potential for pharmacists can be great if you're in certain areas. Yeah, you definitely got to weigh out the decisions. There's definitely a right time for each one. There's ways to do all of this without taking the sacrifice. Like starting your own website, writing on social media. You know, there's ways around it. But mm-hmm. that is, I mean, that's still a sacrifice, right?
Because yeah, still time.
You're not.
Yeah.
It's time with zero compensation.
And you're zero compensation.
Maybe you get enough traffic onto your website that it pays for the website for the first couple of months.
Yeah.
But if you're building that as the sacrifice to have a portfolio to land clients.
Yeah.
And those clients are going to see, oh, they write well and they've been doing this for a year. Oh, they're efficient too. Now those clients, that compensation might be higher.
Mm-hmm.
So that is still a sacrifice too. So I think regardless, it's gotta be a sacrifice, but
so you're
learning a skill too.
Yeah. So you should be going into it with the expectations that just because I have this degree does not mean that I can demand this salary, especially being realistic about where you're at coming into that space.
Yeah.
And being strategic about the projects you're taking on. And then how long it takes for you to feel confident is really about how many reps you're putting in the game.
Yeah.
Yeah, so no, that's really good for people to understand, because they might be looking at it for as a side gig, thinking they're going to come in making a bunch of money. And they might have to put some skin in the game first before you start seeing that.
Yes. But I also, I love that phrase, like, well, just in general, like as a side gig about making a bunch of money. But I mean, realistically, let's define what a lot of money is. I mean,
that is very subjective.
Like, when I got into it, you know, a pharmacist salary is great. But then you look at all the things you have to pay for: student loans, the rent, the cars, mm-hmm. the family. I mean, everything. It's expensive. Mm-hmm. And let's say we have a side gig that makes an extra $3,000 a month. That's crazy.
Yeah, that's great.
That's a ton of money. But what if I offered you a side gig that you were doing, let's see, an extra 20 hours of work a month. So 5 hours a week.
Okay.
But I'm going to pay your car bill and I'm going to pay for your internet every month.
Well, I just leased a car and that bill is billing right now. So okay. Me personally, I'm okay. Like, yeah, yes,
so I'll
sir.
Say my truck payment's $560 and my internet is about 90. So let's just say 650. Let's yeah. Just round to 650. So if I say I would pay $650 a month, but let's not even look at the numbers. I'm just going to pay your car bill and your internet.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty powerful. Now all of a sudden those bills aren't coming out of your salary anymore. Yeah. And so even just the an extra $500 or $600 a month, it doesn't sound like a lot of money, but that could be all your utility bills and whatever. It could be your beer money and utilities. It doesn't have to be thousands extra a month. Just doing one or two articles that are paid a month could be impactful. I mean, mm-hmm. How much is someone's student loan bill? I mean, if we're on income-based repayments, maybe it pays your student loans. Maybe, I mean, there's just so many things that the extra breathing room that even just $500 a month makes is powerful.
Yeah.
And then if that does grow to where now you're making a grand, $1,500, $2,000 extra, but you've gotten efficient to the point that I'm still only doing about 10, 15 hours a week. Let's say it's only 10 hours a week. Mm-hmm. Well, no, that's crazy. If we break it down to the hourly rate, maybe it's not as appealing. And this is just really in general to any side hustle, or any side project, but like, maybe it's not as appealing at the hourly rate compared to what we make as pharmacists at an hourly rate.
For like entry.
Right.
Yeah.
But $500 a month, $1,000 a month, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And it can mean a lot.
So absolutely.
That was my approach to it when we think of just like sacrifice. Like that was how I phrased it.
Yeah, absolutely. And two things I want to hit on that because my brain just bounced around. If you're freelance and you're making $1,000 a month, you're taking 30% out and putting it to the side for taxes on your own.
Saving money. Yeah. That money that's coming in, most of it doesn't even get spent in general. Most of it, I've just been building savings.
You have to manage your own tax deductions for those.
You have to manage your tax deductions, if especially if you're starting your own LLC or that kind of stuff. Yes. Pay your taxes. Do all the right things. For me, though, it was really... I wanted to make sure I had emergency funds and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And just if anything happens, I don't want to have to rely on credit cards. Mm-hmm. So I don't think I really spend a lot of the money that I make from writing, if we're talking about finances now, but it's nice. Yeah.
You're a family man. You better be storing that money right now.
Anything can happen at any point. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the second thing we talked about it, like, You think about how much money you spent to get your degree.
Mm-hmm.
Like you paid them to learn. And you're in how many thousands of dollars of debt, you know? Mm-hmm. So if you can change your mindset to I'm getting paid to learn.
Yeah.
That shift alone can change the way that you go into that situation.
Oh, yeah.
And so it also gives you more time to give yourself grace because you don't have to be a workhorse at it either. You can take your time, take on projects as it's a rate that's comfortable for you.
Yeah, I totally agree. I try to spend, before I was writing, I tried to spend 5 to 10 hours a week trying to stay up to date, reading an article about something or doing something. Now I get paid to do that. Maybe it's on diseases that I shouldn't be spending 10 hours a week reading about.
the orphan drugs and all.
And rare diseases and stuff, yeah. But sometimes it does come out. And writing an article series about certain long-acting injectable antipsychotics.
Mm-hmm.
And now hospitals have programs for the free reimbursements and stuff. You know, and I wrote a CE on continuous glucose monitors. And then I helped write adjust the policy for CGM use in the hospital. And
nice.
I could have still looked up that information and found it, but I already had the information. And it was easier for me to just swing into doing that work at my actual job because it was easier for me to take that on than anybody else because I already have this information.
Yeah.
So there are things that were relating to it, but yeah.
It gives you an advantage if you're still practicing.
Yeah.
Like it gives you an advantage with this information.
But if I was going to be reading 5 or 10 hours a week on average to stay up to date with things, well, I'd rather get paid a little and do it too.
Yeah. And I just want to let them know that like the average person is not reading 5 to 10 hours a week. To stay up to date. I just, because I'm like, whoa,
it's not that much.
Committed.
It's not that much. It's an hour a day. have like some study or something. Oh, this new drug came out. What's that about?
That is wonderful that you believe that that is normal.
It should be. I mean, come on, Stat Plus, it's like a news organization for healthcare. I'd rather read that than like
if we
Fox
did a
or
survey right now of all the healthcare professionals and how much time they spend on a monthly basis, like staying up to date on literature.
Yeah, it's probably not, but I think it should be.
Probably less than 5 to 10 hours in a month.
I mean, at bare minimum, just subscribe to like medical Twitter and just read stuff like that and find some. I'm just saying.
Yeah. Okay.
This is your market. You want them to spend 5 hours a week watching your videos.
Well, they don't have to. Well, if you want to, you can. But no, that's a large commitment. Well, I guess it really depends on your 9 to 5. Also, some 9 to 5s have space created in them for you to get online and to stay up to date. Some jobs they pay you to do your CEs.
Yeah.
Or they built space in.
And I have all of that. Plus, I have about a 7-minute commute to work, so I have plenty of time.
Oh, so, well, you have it there.
But also, I mean, I think for someone who has a long commute or anything else, like just listen to a podcast. Listen to an hour long healthcare podcast where they talk about something. I think that's just as equivalent to reading for 5 hours a week. There's a lot of ways to try to defend myself that other people could be staying up to date for 5 hours a week. But yeah.
No, like we should be doing this. Yeah. This is a role model, ladies and gents. Yeah. No, it's not the average.
I could be better. There are things that
you're doing pretty good. You're doing pretty good.
But anyways, there's ways to get paid to do it.
You can get paid to do it. That was the take home point. That was the take home point. You can get paid to be an all-star.
Yeah.
So before we close, I just want to leave this time for you to pour in wisdom and insight into the audience about. If there was something, if you could go back and tell yourself something about something that you felt impressed to do or a place in the next career move that you wanted to take or you didn't have any experience in it and you were feeling insecure about getting into that space, what's something that you would tell them that could encourage them?
Oh, man. I think I've sprinkled a lot of advice in this whole conversation, but there's transferable skills. Speaking directly to pharmacists or pharmacy students, your career doesn't end if you don't get a residency. Your career is not defined if you did do a residency. I've met terrible residents. I've met terrible clinical pharmacists that did residencies. I've met phenomenal rock star pharmacists that are clinical pharmacists that didn't do a residency. Mm-hmm. Neither of those are definitively true. Doing a residency does not mean you're great. Not getting a residency does not mean you're not great. It's you as the individual. Are you still growing yourself? Mm-hmm. Are you writing on LinkedIn or whatever? Are you finding ways to grow yourself and advance yourself? And breaking into any new career, unless it's some massive deviation away from what you're doing. Like if I'm going from being a pharmacist to being a mathematician, I'm probably going to restart from zero. Mm-hmm. I know a little kinetics, but that's not math. That's not what they do. But everything I'm going to do as a career switch is going to be some relation to what I already do. There are transferable skills. How do you market that? Can you market yourself? And there are hundreds of ways to market yourself and network and figure out different ways to match those skill requirements to break in. And I think today the hiring market is changing to where the potential of the person is more attractive than the requirements. Do you have a PharmD? I'm thinking of like getting into industry or getting into hospital work and that kind of stuff. Do you have a PharmD? Yes. Okay, great. Who are you after that? Because everybody that applies is probably gonna have a PharmD.
Yeah.
Who are you? So example I was giving a student the other day was, you know, let's say you have two people applying for a hospital job to be a clinical pharmacist. Both people are retail experience only. So CVS, Walgreens, whichever, you know, a community pharmacy experience only. None of them have hospital experience. Neither of them. So anyways, the two people, one does a residency, one doesn't. The one that does a residency goes to community pharmacy afterwards, does some type of 50-50 ambulatory care type work or whatever. The one that didn't do residency goes straight to community pharmacy. So they're both kind of doing the same job. Both have PharmDs. One's residency trained, one not. The person that is residency trained for the next 5 years doesn't really do anything to grow themselves. They didn't start any new program or whatever.
Yeah.
This other pharmacist that went straight to community pharmacy became pharmacy manager, have started X amount of programs, has met X amount of metrics, has started medical writing or has a blog that they keep up about certain things, started a diabetes program to help people. Are you still growing yourself as a, at this point, if both of these people are applying to a hospital job, I don't care anymore if either of them did a residency or not. I want, what did you do in the last 5 years after pharmacy school or after residency that makes you who you are as the pharmacist? I see the potential in this person over here, not this one. So to swing it back to your question, if you're transferring jobs or career change, what are your transferable skills? And as you as the person, have you continued to grow after pharmacy school? It's all about you learning new things and growing and that kind of stuff. And if you're still doing that, I can't imagine it's that hard for that person that's still growing to make a career change or to shift. There is one last thing. I think we had kind of mentioned like certificates and requirements to be a medical writer. I don't believe in certificates for a lot of things, which is kind of counterintuitive to what I just said of still growing and that kind of stuff. But when it comes to medical writing, I think APHA, they do have a lot of certificates. I think they do have one in medical writing. If you do that program, and it's not expensive, I think it's like $400 or $500 for like 20 something CEs, 20 hours of CEs, all medical writing based. If you're doing that certificate program to have the certificate title on your CV to define you as that, I think that's the wrong reason to do it. But if you're doing that certificate because you look at the program list and you're like, oh, I'm going to learn about how to interpret studies. Oh, I'm going to learn about how to analyze this. I'm going to learn this type of writing style. I'm going to learn this. If you're doing it to learn the skills that they're teaching, then I think it's a phenomenal resource. And at that point, I don't even know if you have to put it on your CV. If you can just prove, I know all this stuff. I learned this stuff. Here are the writing. There's my writing portfolio that shows I know all this stuff. Versus the person that has that certificate just listed on their CV, you're going to be better on this other choice of knowing and learning the stuff. Yeah. So I think that's my final piece of advice.
So I'm going to summarize. I'm going to do my best to summarize what you said.
Okay.
But the takeaways.
Yeah.
For those of you who are looking to get into another area, but you don't feel like you have the qualifications or the skill sets, Dr. Tony Rodriguez just said, do a self audit and identify the areas that you're strong at. And I identify all of the qualities that you do have and skills that you do have that are going to translate to that next area that you are interested in, which means you will have to do some research on that area to know what they're looking for, what it takes to do well in there. And then you do your audit and you find out what you have that does well. And you can also identify what doesn't do so well too. So you just are aware of your weaknesses and areas to improve. I'm expanding upon your points.
Yeah.
Number two, don't just chase certificates and titles thinking that they're going to make up for the real qualities that matter.
Chase the skills.
Yeah. You can have that title, but when it comes time to produce that work, if you don't know it, it's going to show. And you'll be better off actually knowing it than just having a title that says that you do. And the third take-home point, were there three take-home points? Or I think you pretty much
hit the two main ones. I think if you were to add a third one, just write.
Just write.
Just write.
Just write.
I've said that multiple times. There's no reason to not write. If you're interested in it, you have multiple avenues to
just
write.
Just do it.
Just write. Yeah, not to sound like a meme, but yeah, just do it. Just write.
Shout out to Nike. But yeah, like you said it a couple times, analysis paralysis. Mm-hmm. And that is what I take away from analysis paralysis is you're so stuck and scared to get things wrong that you just don't start. Mm-hmm. And you're also thinking that if you're doing all your research, if you keep learning and studying, that you feel like you're making headway, but you're sort of still not because you still haven't actually started.
Yeah.
And you can't improve a system if the system doesn't exist. So you have to.
That's a good way to put it.
I got that from somebody else. I ain't gonna take credit for it. I paraphrased it, you know, but I be doing my podcast, listening, my mental dieting.
Yep.
But I've heard that you can't improve a system that doesn't exist. And that is so true. And an example of that is literally me filming myself talking with other pharmacists in the field on my couch in my house because I just wanted to. And like I didn't wait to get a studio. I didn't, you know, like I didn't wait to get all this huge fancy equipment. Like we in here on my couch, y'all. We're just,
it's a pretty comfortable couch.
It is a nice couch. Shout out to Big Lots, you know. But yeah, it's, you just got to do it. I'm going to make a fourth point. Do it scared. Do it scared.
That's great. Yeah.
Do it scared.
I'm the opposite of you. I've had that website. I've yet to publish it because I'm waiting for it to be the right level that I think needs to represent me. So I think there's an appropriate time frame to have built it and that kind of stuff. I've been working on it for 2.5 years since I started this. I had an idea of what I wanted to do. I've owned this domain for 2.5 years. And it's only 5 months ago, that I've put my foot down to myself and said, you're publishing it in July. Regardless, like it's time to get over it. It's excessive to have a 15-page outline for what I want the website to be.
Goodness
when
gracious.
I should have just started it. I should have started on the couch. I should have not waited to have the right computer set up or whatever.
Yeah.
I should have just done it on my laptop, on the couch. Like I should have just started it.
Yeah.
But I'm getting there. It should have been 6 months, not 2.5 years. So to be the counterpoint, don't be me on that part. Just start it.
Yeah. It's a balance. You definitely want to take time to do the research, know what you're getting into, but you should know when you're really just stalling it out at a certain point.
Yeah.
So we're gonna end on that note. Thank you, Tony.
Yeah, this was fun. Great.
And yeah, I hope that you were blessed by the things that we talked about today. And thank you for tuning in into Pharmacy Pathways. Bye.